consistently. He's somebody who obfuscates persistently. And so when he admits that there are going to be bank failures, we should batten down the hatches and expect things are going to get really ugly really soon. Now, just this last week, I published on my blog, Pro Libertate, an essay entitled Prepare to Panic. And as I explained this afternoon, the title comes from an episode of Get Smart, which was a spy spoof back in the 1960s, and I believe that it was a masterpiece of political satire, that series. And every once in a while in that television series, there'd be something I thought provides wisdom for the edification of people who are trying to know what's really going on.
Well, hold that thought there for just a moment as we bring our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was talking about the remarks made by Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank here, and the Federal Reserve system, to the effect that there would be some bank failures. We could anticipate that. And then, of course, William was referring to a episode of Get Smart. I don't know how many of you remember it, but it's one of my favorite favorite programs. It was a 30-minute spoof program. It was about, of course, this, a man who was a bumbling idiot who was the one of the top-notch of the agents of the Central Intelligence Agency. But go ahead and tell the story, William.
Well, in this particular episode, Maxwell Smart and his sidekick, Agent 99, have been abducted by Hans Siegfried of Chaos, who's their arch nemesis. And they end up aboard a U-boat, a submarine owned by Chaos, and they're under attack, this submarine is, by a U.S. Navy destroyer that's dropping depth charges that are coming perilously close to the sub. And as the depth charges go off in the distance, Siegfried's crew starts to become a little bit uneasy, and 99, seeking to capitalize on the situation, says to Siegfried, "Look, Siegfried, your men are panicking," to which Siegfried replies, "You are wrong about that. My men are thoroughly trained. They will not panic until I give the order to panic." And at that point, a depth charge goes off right next to the submarine, and Siegfried, somewhat rattled, says, "Prepare to panic." The point here is that he had the luxury of being able to order his men at what point they could panic. What I say is that right now, in the circumstances we confront as heads of households, as consumers, as people who want to have some semblance of economic normalcy in our lives, this is the perfect time to panic. We've not yet been given permission by our rulers to panic. That is to say, to undertake right now, with all appropriate speed and all deliberate action, to provide for the survival of our assets in this rapidly approaching catastrophe. And if we wait until we're given explicit permission to panic, it'll be too late. We'll be caught in the undertow and dragged down. Now, in terms of the auguries of this catastrophe, there are four or five really solid predictions from very respectable people, estimable people who are in the world of high finance and also in the world of market analysis. Just recently on CNN, there was a breathtakingly candid discussion of the upcoming inflationary depression that's sometimes referred to as stagflation, when you have stagnant or even negative growth and high price inflation. It's necessary at this point, by the way, to draw a distinction between price inflation and monetary inflation. Monetary inflation is where the government simply emits currency to the point where it's bringing about a decline in the value of the currency. I mean, every time you create more of something, its value goes down. So the government emits currency, it is inflating the currency. That's monetary inflation. Price inflation is the effect of monetary inflation. You feel it in terms of rising prices. When the government creates more money, prices go up because it requires more of the debased currency in order to buy the goods or services that you're looking for. And government always gets the benefit of the first use of the inflated currency. So that's an important principle to remember here. But we're headed for an inflationary or hyperinflationary depression. This was discussed on CNN just in the last week or so. And by the time this discussion moves into the realm of CNN or Fox Business News, or when you see it discussed in the pages of major journals and newspapers, it's a pretty sure thing that we're headed in that direction, indeed, that it's already begun. That's one augury of this impending catastrophe. Another one comes from Bernard Connolly, the global strategist at Bank AIG in London, who claims that, and I quote now, "The likelihood of a Great Depression is growing by the day." Some of you might be acquainted with Dr. Noriel Rabini of New York University's Stern School of Business. about 2 weeks ago, he published, I believe, by way of the Reuters News Service, a schematic of 12 steps that outline how the losses in the U.S. financial sector in the aggregate will grow to more than $1 trillion. $1 trillion is 1 million times $1 million, to put that in some sense of perspective. And that amount is equal to all of the assets of all American banks. So, if Dr. Rabini is correct, then Mr. Bernanke is not kidding when he says that we're going to have a bank failure. We're probably going to have a number of bank failures, because the losses in the financial sector are going to be at least the gross equivalent of all of the assets claimed by all of the banks. They don't have assets. Once again, they do not have assets equivalent to $1 trillion. That's what they claim, but they're all fractional reserve banks. So they don't have assets in that realm of numbers. Then there's a commentary from the Intelligencer out of Canada that makes this following point, commenting on Dr. Rabini's analysis. Every day now, thousands of people all over the U.S. and Great Britain are walking away from their homes, simply mailing their house keys to the banks as housing bailout plans fail. With unemployment growing, the next phase that will hit commercial real estate, making the financial institutions the unwilling owners, not only of quickly depreciating houses, but also of empty strip malls and even larger shopping centers. That's something we've seen reported, I believe, through the MSN news service on the Internet. They had a very large piece about 2 weeks ago talking about the forthcoming bursting of the commercial real estate bubble. And then, once again, out of the Intelligencer, we continue, the next domino to fall will be credit card defaults. And after that, who knows? There are so many exotic funds out there with trillions of dollars in paper, or rather computer screen money, all carrying assorted acronyms and all about to disintegrate into nothingness. Over the next couple of years, scores of banks that have thrived on these devices based on quickly disappearing equities will fail. Now, how quickly will they fail? And this brings us to the projection from a very elite bulletin, which is put out not only in English but also French and German, called the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin, or GEAB. It's very expensive. It costs about $300 a year for 16 issues. This is something which is circulated among high-end investors and analysts throughout Europe and the United States. And the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin says the following. The end of the third quarter of 2008, late September, or roughly about 7 months from now, will be marked by a new tipping point in the unfolding of the global systemic crisis. At that time, indeed, the cumulated impact of the various sequences of the crisis will reach its maximum strength and affect decisively the very heart of the systems concerned, the front line of which is the United States, the epicenter of the current crisis. In the United States, this new tipping point will translate into a collapse of the real economy, the final socioeconomic stage of the serial bursting of the housing and financial bubbles and of the pursuance of the U.S. dollar fall. The collapse of the U.S. real economy means the virtual freeze of the American economic machinery, private and public bankruptcies in large numbers, company and public services closing down. They're projecting this once again for some time around September of this year, and that's once again a prediction being made by the people who assemble one of the most highly respected market analysis journals, which is circulated in three languages among people who are really important decision makers in the world of ultra-rarefied finance. And commenting upon that report, the Canadian journal The Intelligencer says the following. We are not experiencing a remake of the 1929 crisis, nor a repetition of the 1970s oil crises or the 1987 stock market crisis. What we will have instead is a truly global momentous threat, a true turning point affecting the entire planet and questioning the very foundations of the international system upon which the world was organized in the last decade. The report emphasizes that it is first and foremost in the United States where this historic happening is taking an unprecedented shape. The authors call it, quote, very great U.S. depression. It continues to predict that although this crucial event is global, it will be the beginning of an economic decoupling between the United States and the rest of the world. However, non-decoupled economies will be dragged down the U.S. negative spiral. And that's already happening right now. And right now, it's interesting to see how there are at least some of the countries that are involved in importing the United States inflation, helping to monetize our debt by having their central banks peg their currencies to the dollar and inflating their central bank currencies, which of course means that the consumers in these countries have to pay inflated prices, and also that their governments are buying up our treasury notes so as to keep the dollar stable. A lot of these countries are now starting, they have been for a couple of years, they have been flaking off in terms of their purchase of U.S. debt securities, and a number of them are talking about decoupling their currencies from the dollar. And one of the people pursuing this, suggesting this course of action, and tell me if this isn't something that would make the normal person furious to the point of being blind with rage, is Alan Greenspan. He was just in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago at an investors conference in Jeddah, recommending that investors in the Arab world get out of dollar-denominated assets and that the governments in the region decouple their currencies from the dollar to destroy the dollar peg. This is the individual who did the most in the history of the world to destroy the U.S. dollar. And now, after wreaking this destruction on the U.S. dollar, he's over in the Arab world telling these people to bail out of the dollar. And the consequence of that would be this very great depression that's being described here in this bulletin, this Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin.
Well, I think the reason, of course, Alan Greenspan said this, working as a consultant for the Dresden Bank, but one of the things he says is that you don't want to have inflation here in the Arab countries. You've got to decouple from the American dollar.
Mm-hmm.
What people really don't understand is we have inflation. Certainly, if you read Ben Bernanke's testimony, it was, I think, 27th of February, just a little over 10 days ago. Why, Ben Bernanke said, you know, certainly there's no significant inflation. We've looked at the commodity index, the indexes, and we see no evidence of inflation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bernanke is lying.
Yeah.
We have inflation that's running at least 10%. And, of course, they have something called hedonics, which is a means of calculating the inflation rate that simply distorts the truth. All you have to do is certainly go to the store, look at the price of gasoline, see what's happening to prices of health care, of medicines, and understand that prices are going through the roof. And Ben Bernanke says there's no inflation. Why would he say that? Because the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that inflation destroys the value of a currency and ultimately the nation. We'll go right ahead there.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the fact that people, on the basis of the evidence of their eyes and the evidence of their declining household balance sheets, should be able to contradict what we're being told in terms of the rate of inflation being as supposedly negligible as the Federal Reserve would tell us. I mean, obviously, if we had a sound currency and a sound economy, we wouldn't have price inflation. But they're talking about pegging inflation to a relatively modest rate, but even if it were only as low as the so-called core inflation rate would have us believe, that would be catastrophic in the long run. But the real inflation rate, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, is somewhere around 16% at the very least. Just today, for instance, when I was driving around doing errands after our previous conversation on the radio this afternoon, I noticed that here in Payette, Idaho, and this is a town of about 7,000 people, it's located right on the Oregon border. And traditionally, we pay less for gasoline in this part of the state than anybody else in the state of Idaho, where the price of gasoline is usually running very, very much lower than what you'd find in California. But between this morning, when I noticed that gas prices had gone up 3 cents a gallon since yesterday, and this afternoon, gasoline prices went up another 4 cents. That's in the course of less than 24 hours. You have a 7 cent increase in the price of a gallon of gasoline here in Payette, Idaho, which is not one of your larger markets for gasoline. If you take a look at what's going on with the price of staple foods in the grocery store, if you're talking about anything that's made out of the basic cereal grains, such as wheat and corn and rice, if you buy breakfast cereals, I'm the father of five small children, we buy breakfast cereal, you notice that the price of breakfast cereal has gone parabolic, and that reflects the fact that wheat is at an all-time high in terms of the price per bushel. And similar things are happening with corn and rice. Some of this is driven, in the case of corn, for instance, by government subsidy of ethanol, which is a horrible boondoggle that should be ended immediately. But a lot of it, most of it, has to do with the fact that the dollar's value is plummeting relative to the market value of the commodity. And if you take a look at what's going on in the foreign exchange realm right now, every single day the dollar digs itself into a new low against the euro, which is another fiat currency issued by an overtly socialist government. And yet the dollar is performing more poorly than the euro. And when you talk once again about core inflation and what we're being told versus what we're experiencing, you mentioned, Dr. Stan, this concept of hedonics, which is one of these incantatory words that the Federal Reserve uses in order to cover up the fundamental dishonesty of what they're doing. The core inflation rate is calculated in a way that strips from that figure the factors of food and energy. In other words, they calculate consumer inflation, price inflation, on the basis of a assembly of figures that have nothing to do with the essentials that we need for living. We cannot live without food. We cannot live a modern life without energy. They take those out of the inflation calculations in terms of the consumer prices that we pay. And once again, this is something that was discussed on the CNN program just a few days ago. That's one of the grand secrets of the palace, if you will. Not many people in the establishment have been willing to own up to the fact that the core inflation rate is a palpable, deliberate fraud. And yet, that's something that was being overtly discussed on a news service that really doesn't traffic in the truth for the most part. So when the truth has become so obvious that CNN will speak it, we know we're in for some very bad times. Oh, another thing that I think is interesting is that there was a...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with William Greig about inflation. Inflation, of course, is running about 10%. They are simply lying to the American people. They calculate the rate of inflation now with something known as hedonics, H-E-D-O-N-I-C-S. It's a new means of taking inflation, and you calculate it, figuring that, well, the price of beef is going up, so, of course, the price of chicken is not, so people are going to switch from beef to chicken, and so we will not, of course, increase the price of their meat products, because now they're going to be eating chicken rather than expensive meat. And, of course, how could you make this sort of an assumption? Certainly they ignore the skyrocketing prices in literally every field, and they do this very specifically. Why? Well, because if they told the truth, since the legislature has linked the Social Security payments to rate of inflation, if it's only 2.1% core inflation, why, if that's all they have to raise the Social Security checks? Whereas, of course, if they told the truth, they'd have to give at least 10% rise every year. The same thing is true with indexed treasury bills. A lot of people have bought treasury bills that are indexed to inflation. And, of course, if they told the truth, they would have to pay them a 10% increase in the value of the treasury bills every year. But they're not going to do that. It's far easier to lie, and it is an organized program on the part of the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. to lie so they can steal from the elderly, so they can steal from the people who have bought the Treasury indexed bonds which are indexed to inflation, and, of course, really to conceal the truth of what's going on. So pick it up from there, William.
Well, I have a question for you, Dr. Stan. I don't know this off the top of my head, but it just occurs to me. When Congress votes itself a pay raise, does it vote itself a pay raise based upon the same inflation rate that they use to calculate Social Security payments and the other calculations you're talking about with respect to T-bills and the like? Or do they vote themselves the pay raise based on the real inflation rate?
Well, I really can't answer that, but
okay,
I suspect
I'm
gonna
look
they're looking
into
after themselves rather than looking after you and I.
I'm going to look into that because I suspect the latter is the case. I suspect that when they give themselves a pay raise, that it goes in several multiples of what they do by way of increasing the COLA and Social Security payments or things of that sort. And so that would be a really good way of knowing exactly what the inflation rate is. You take a look at the percentage increase when Congress votes itself a pay raise. I'll take that under advisement and look into it.
Please do it. Let me know what you find.
Yeah, I will. It just occurred to me as we were having this conversation. But when we were talking about the effect of price inflation on staple foods here in the U.S. economy, and as we were talking about that, I happen to remember a piece that I saw on the BBC News Service that I believe was probably republished on Infowars.com or some other source of that variety, where the World Food Program of the United Nations says that food prices for some items rose 40% last year, And they're talking about the impact this is having on a number of economically marginal countries, such as, well, Afghanistan, which is very economically marginal and not a country in any sense that I'd recognize. Bangladesh, you could say the same thing. El Salvador, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Senegal, Morocco. In other words, these places where people live on a pittance, and suddenly they find that their subsistence items, such as, you know, wheat, we'd mentioned the price of wheat, that those prices have gone up between 30% and 40%, people are starting to starve in places like that. So, of course, the United Nations, in its estimable Olympian wisdom, has said that governments now have to take measures in order to control the price of these various food items. Well, if you have price controls, you end up with what? You end up with shortages. You know, if you keep the price artificially low, people aren't going to produce, and so you end up with shortages, and that will, of course, exacerbate the problem of starvation. But I suspect that when we end up going parabolic or hyperbolic here in terms of consumer inflation, we're probably going to see pressure for the same type of non-remedy, the same thing we've seen with respect to gasoline prices, and the same thing that brought about what we saw in the late 1970s with the oil crunch. That was in large measure a product of government intervention to prevent the refining of petroleum into gasoline, and also government price controls that created artificial scarcity. And I suspect we're going to see the same thing happen here in the United States that we're seeing in these other countries, the biggest difference being that we're wealthier in a subjective sense than these other countries. I mean, we're the biggest debtor nation in the world, so we're not wealthier in an objective sense. But we could see rationing and price controls, and as a result, genuine hunger and perhaps even starvation in this country, perhaps before the end of the decade.
Well, of course, the interesting thing is that rice hit an all-time high within the last two or three days. Wheat has as well. We're seeing a rise in the price of soybeans. We're seeing a rise in the price of all of the staple products, not only in the United States, throughout the world. And even the United Nations is talking about the possibility that we will have to have some sort of a rationing program, and not only in third world nations, but even in first world nations, so there will not be frank famine. People say that could never happen in America. And I would like to say, if God is just, why couldn't it happen in America? Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is William Griggs. You picked the story up there, William.
One thing we have to talk about in terms of the possibility here, the likelihood. I'm saying we're no longer facing a possibility, but we're actually confronting the likelihood, if not the inevitability, of a huge inflationary or hyperinflationary depression in the United States. We have to go back and key on the statement that Bernanke made before Congress last week about there will be bank failures, almost certainly. And we've already seen bank runs erupt in Great Britain and Spain and a couple of other places. One thing that we can learn from the bank run in England involving the Northern Rock Bank is the fact that those larger entities that are supposed to backstop some of these smaller banks, Northern Rock's a fairly large bank but is small in the global perspective, but the banks that are supposed to backstop these other smaller banks are not doing so well themselves. The story of Northern Rock, I'll digest it very quickly, is relevant here. Northern Rock is the fifth largest mortgage lender in Great Britain. I think they have something like 80,000 active mortgages on the books. And in September, as they were starting to confront their insolvency crisis, they quietly made a request to the Bank of England, that country's central bank, for assistance. And news of this leaked out to the public. Now, the request was made in order to forestall a run on the bank. And leaking the news, of course, provoked the bank run. And over the course of one weekend, the bank lost $4 billion. It was £4 billion, which would be almost $9 billion, if I remember correctly. £4 billion off its balance sheets as people went in and withdrew their money from the bank. And once again, this is a perfect example of the principle that if you wait until you're given permission to panic, it's too late. The BBC's cameras were on scene as these people were queuing up by the hundreds and thousands to get their money out. And they were all being asked the same question, these depositors were, by the interviewers in the BBC. Isn't this an instance of panic? Isn't this something that represents an irrational reaction or an overreaction to this request for help? And one after another, these smiling, composed people said, no, this is perfectly rational. I mean, what I'm doing is perfectly rational. What we're doing is we're protecting our household assets. There's one of them who said, we've been assured time and time again that there's no problem, but that's what the captain of the Titanic said, wasn't it? Well, Northern Rock lost 4 billion pounds over the course of a weekend, and so we saw the British government working with people from the highest strata of finance get together and talk about a rescue plan for this bank. And one of the people involved was Richard Branson, who's a remarkably successful entrepreneur.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with William. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was talking about, of course, what's happening over in Great Britain as far as the Northern Rock Bank. But before we go into that any further, I'd like William to get his website out. It's a blog site, and then tell you how to get copies of his book. So how can people get your blog site? How can people get copies of your book?
Well, in order to do both, the best and most efficient way to do it is to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. The Right Source is a news site. It has news stories and commentaries and links to video clips and other multimedia that we find to be worthwhile. The address is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to the homepage of The Right Source or the Welch Foundation, I work for the Welch Foundation as editor-at-large for their various media enterprises. Go to rightsourceonline.com. At the top of that page, you'll find a banner ad for my new book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order it right there from the website. And if you scroll down about a third of the way down the front page, look at the left-hand margin of the screen, you'll see my photograph, and next to my photograph there will be a hyperlink which will take you to my blog. My blog is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. I update that blog between 3 and 5 times a week, depending upon my schedule. And my intent in publishing that blog is to provide not only a chronicle of the various assaults on liberty and to get people as infuriated as I possibly can over the constant assaults on what remains of our liberty, but hopefully to catalyze people into a state of mind in which they are willing to do something about it, even if that means simply digging in your feet intransigently and not permitting these things to go unchallenged or unremarked. You can be amazed how much of a difference it would make if people simply would admit the reality of what's happening in our country. And if enough people were to do that, as loudly as possible, as conspicuously as they could, I really believe the change would occur very quickly. And Pro Libertate, the blog, once again, can be accessed through this webpage, rightsourceonline.com, as can the Pro Libertate e-zine or e-journal. There's an infrequently published journal of the same name. We have a new issue in the pipeline for this month that should be available quite soon, and I help to edit that publication as well. And once again, I want to thank you objectively for your patience and my failures to get you a quantity of the book for sale through Radio Liberty. And as soon as it's all at all possible, I will undertake great exertions to make sure that you have that book to make available to your listeners. I have to say, by way of personal privilege here, that my wife Corinne is now home after a very long hospitalization, and that's a tremendous blessing to me and to our family. We really appreciate your prayers and concerns on our behalf, Dr. Stan, and those of your listeners who have taken an interest in our condition. And that, of course, will make it possible for me to attend to some things with a little bit more diligence than I've displayed previously. I'll be able to attend to little details like making sure that you get that book in quantity so that we can sell it to your listeners.
Well, I certainly don't know how you're able to accomplish what you do, because, of course, with 5 children and no wife to help you, you know, it's a terrible burden. So we certainly understand the quandary you've been in, and we think no less of you, because there's been some delay. We're looking forward to getting the book, though. It's called Liberty in Eclipse, and you can get it right now at rightsource.com. Hopefully one day we'll have it, make it available to our listeners as well. Well, basically, Sidney William was talking about what's going on with Northern Rock Bank in England, and of course, what are they going to do? Here's a bank that's lost a couple of $1 billion. You have to understand that banks have to have assets. Mm-hmm. They need those reserves. They have to have a fraction of the reserves to back up their lending. In other words, maybe 8, 10, 12%, something like that. But if they don't have reserves, they can't lend. If they can't lend, a bank can't exist. So anyway, Northern Rock is facing a traditional bank run, and it's losing a significant part of its assets, so that the bank faces insolvency. When that happens, of course, they have to call in their loans, or certainly they would be declared bankrupt and either fail, or certainly have to sell off all their assets at bargain rate prices, and then the shareholders would lose everything. They're in a terrible strait. So what happened at that point?
What happened at that point was that the government of Great Britain, working with some people in some of the more elitist realms of finance, decided they were going to put together a rescue package for Northern Rock so that the contagion of a bank run wouldn't spread. One of the people they approached was Richard Branson, who's made quite a name for himself as an entrepreneur, both in music and in commercial aviation. He's the fellow who wants to begin civilian space transport as a new means of transportation, where he'd be able to get on a rocket plane in New York and get to Australia in just a couple of hours, that type of thing. He's a visionary, in other words, and a risk-taker. Well, he didn't want anything to do with bailing out Northern Rock Bank unless he had big boys behind him who could provide him with capital. And one of the big boys behind him was Citigroup. Citigroup was going to ride to the rescue of Northern Rock. They were all saddled up, and they were digging their spurs into their mounts when suddenly it was discovered that, you know what, Citigroup isn't that healthy either. They just received something on the order of a $7 billion bailout from a consortium of Arab investors, and it didn't look as if they were going to be able to do something towards the end of helping Northern Rock. They had to attend to their own ailing balance sheet. And so, as a result, just 2.5 or 3 weeks ago, the government of Great Britain nationalized Northern Rock Bank. And this is not going to be the last time this is going to happen. And it's going to happen across the Atlantic. It's going to happen on this side of the pond as well. But I want to focus a little bit more on Citigroup here. Citigroup, of course, is, if I'm not mistaken, I think the world's largest financial entity of that type. And it's, of course, a hugely respected establishment financial concern. It's sort of one of the marquee names in the world of high finance.
It's actually the largest bank in the United States. Bank in the world. The largest bank in the world is HSBC, which most people don't even know. That's the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC. It's only recently come to the fore. But remember, certainly it was back in the 1980s where 8 of the 10 largest banks in the world were Japanese banks.
Mm-hmm.
And a decade later, those banks had penny stocks. They were some of the poorest banks. And this may very well be the fate of HSBC. But right now, of course, Citicorp is what they call it. Citicorp is the largest single bank in the United States. And it is on the verge of insolvency. Go right ahead.
And so they received this huge buy-in from two sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf region. Those are government-managed investment instruments, usually created by people, that is to say, governments that are in the business of exporting energy, petroleum, natural gas, things of that sort. I think Norway was the first country to start one. But Kuwait is a sovereign investment fund, and also one of the United Arab Emirates, I believe it was Dubai, also ponied up several billion dollars to help rescue Citibank. And then One of the larger Saudi investors, Prince Alawid bin Talal, was also involved in helping to bail out Citigroup. Well, a few days ago, there was an item in the Reuters financial press about describing the bailout of Citicorp, and the assessment from the Arab investors was that Citi is in much bigger trouble than they had assumed, and that it's going to have to come up with more capital of its own in order to keep its Arab investors, the philanthropic Arab investors interested in bailing out Citi. Citi's going to have to find some other assets because they're in very, very big trouble. So what that tells me is that Citi, given what we heard, in the first segment here about this impending crisis at the end of the third quarter this year. I think Citi is going to be the bellwether bank failure, that Citi is going to go under probably no later than September of this year, and it'll be like the sinking of the Titanic. It'll create a huge vortex that'll begin the process of sucking in just about everything else that's connected to it in the financial sector. And if that happens, we're going to see to alter the metaphor somewhat, a huge financial black hole open up in the middle of the American banking system. And I just don't know how much damage is going to be done, but given the fact that you have these trillions and trillions of dollars out there in investment instruments that very few people can identify or recognize, much less analyze in terms of how to get some kind of capital out of them, I suspect that we're confronting probably the plenary meltdown of the American banking sector. And that brings up another point that I find really interesting. There was an article about 4 or 5 days ago in one of the financial news wires talking about the fact that a lot of people who have gone into default on their mortgages are managing to get by without being evicted from their homes because nobody knows who owns the debt. The debt has been sold so many times and rebundled and repackaged into so many arcane financial instruments that nobody can really establish a chain of possession so that somebody can actually go out and repossess the property in question. And it's gotten to the point where many banks, many lending institutions, I think there are probably 60 or 70 of the major mortgage institutions that went out of business just in the last year or so. So many of those that survive right now are filing what is called missing note affidavits in an attempt to assert ownership over various mortgages. And that's just one illustration of the fact that nobody knows what's in these instruments that have been circulated here, these so-called investment instruments that are usually just repackaged garbage loans that have been used as assets for so long. And there's not a bank, there's not a financial entity in this country that is free and clear of this. And so if Citi goes under and starts to pull on that particular thread, I suspect that a whole lot of people are going to be pulled down in the vortex with them. And I think that's probably the crisis that this European newsletter, Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin is referring to, that would happen in September of this year, that could trigger what they call the Very Great American Depression of 2008.
Of course, another aspect of this, of course, is the derivative mess, and
yes,
somewhere between $600 and $700 trillion in derivatives out there. That's trillion dollars. I mean, there's only about $45 trillion in the whole world, and yet there's $600 trillion in derivatives, and of course these are certain guarantees that the bonds will be paid for, and of course they made a bet. That the municipalities, that the homeowners, that the school boards will pay their bonds, that the corporations will be able to continue paying the interest on their bonds. But what happens if they don't? Well, then, of course, the companies that have insured that will actually have to come up with the money, but they don't have the money. And some of the largest companies that deal with the insurance of what they call them, derivatives or credit swaps on the collateralized debt obligations, on the asset-backed securities, on the structured investment vehicles, and all these fancy names they give to these vehicles, there's no money to back them up. And that, of course, is going to create tremendous problems. And as Warren Buffett said, derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal. And I think we're rapidly approaching that point of lethality.
What you're discussing here could be described as better investing through the use of a creative thesaurus. I mean, they have generated all these bogus neologisms, all of these glittering high maintenance terms to describe fraud. I mean, any way you look at it, we're dealing here with a species of fraud. I mean, basically you have a Ponzi scheme of unprecedented proportions that's being disguised through the use of these arcane terms. And this has all been abetted by the Federal Reserve, which is the the world's preeminent fraud, perhaps the largest fraud in the history of mankind, certainly one of the most, if not the most, influential criminal organizations in the history of mankind. It's nothing more or less than a counterfeiting entity. It's the official counterfeiting arm of the regime that rules us. But when we talk about what's likely to happen late this year or perhaps next year, one of the things I mentioned this afternoon, Dr. Stan, that I think bears repeating here is the prediction by John Williams, who publishes a website called U.S. Government Shadow Statistics. This is a fellow who is in charge of publishing the real statistics about inflation, about the size of our debts, of our outstanding financial obligations, both the government and, of course, the larger financial system. His web address is www.shadowstats.com. That's S-H-A-D-O-S-T-A-T-S, shadowstats.com. John Williams has the following to say about what's likely to happen, in his opinion, almost inevitable, over the next couple of years, a year and a half. And I quote, "If not for systemic intervention and manipulations by the Federal Reserve, it appears we might be contemplating a collapsed U.S. banking system and a looming deflationary Great Depression that could have dwarfed the bad times of the 1930s. Such is the good news. The bad news is that with those same systemic interventions, the Fed is locking in a hyperinflationary Great Depression in the decade ahead, with the turmoil possibly breaking by 2010 or earlier." So what he's saying is that basically, by 2010, we're going to see and feel the effects of a hyperinflationary depression. I believe that we're already seeing the beginning, that we're past the point of having the first pebbles of the avalanche. Right now, we're looking around and we're seeing this collapsing, this cascade of debris collapsing upon us and saying, okay, how bad is this likely to get? Well, we don't know how bad it's likely to get. We can make something of an educated guess, but nobody knows for sure what volume we're going to be dealing with here in terms of the actual damage. But one thing is certain, if people do not take steps right now to protect their wealth and their earnings by minimizing their debt, getting out of debt to the extent possible, it has to be done right away. If you can at all, by any means, get out of debt, do it right away. And also by diversifying out of the dollar into something that represents a permanent store of value, precious metals particularly, and also buy some of the physical assets you're going to need in the event of severe price spikes in food or energy. That's something that we have to look forward to as well, I'm afraid. People have to take those steps right now while things are still relatively tranquil, and while the pain that would be incurred by taking the necessary steps would be relatively minimal. If they don't do that right now, it's going to be too late. If you wait until early next year, chances are it's going to be too late. If you wait till this fall, chances are it's going to be too late. And one thing that I want to ventilate here is just a possibility, just a subject that would be the grounds for some useful speculation, is this following question. If, may God save us from such a fate, we have a huge market meltdown and financial collapse sometime in September, what's going to happen around November when the election comes around? That's just something I would like to see discussed and examined soberly but urgently.
Well, I think that we're going to see it. This is going to be one of the most exciting years of our lives. I'm firmly convinced of it. Our guest this evening has been William Grigg. And, of course, the website is www.rightsourceonline.com. rightsourceonline.com. His book can be purchased there, The Eclipse of Liberty. The Eclipse of Liberty. Ladies and gentlemen, we are facing losing our liberty. But, of course, as William points out, an eclipse is a temporary event. Of course, the light disappears and it's dark, but of course you can come out on the other end. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Hang on there, William. Be back in just a moment. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, it's my hope, and I don't know if it's a forlorn hope or a fruitful one, that when what we're describing comes about, and I don't see how we can avoid it, that something of the resilient decency and strength and industry of the American character will assert itself. And I know, and you know, Dr. Stan, that there are millions of people in this country who are conversant with the principles of our founding fathers, with the principles of sound money. They're people who organize their lives according to God's law as they understand it, as they've been given wisdom to understand what God desires of us, the Ten Commandments, the golden text from the Old Testament, the golden rule, the two great commandments, love the Lord thy God and love your neighbor as yourself. There are millions of people in this country who still strive to live according to those precepts. And I believe that one thing that's going to happen is that we're going to see a shakeout here, that people who are trying to live according to those elevated principles are going to do relatively well. And I'm not abundantly optimistic about what our country is going to look like a year and a half or so from now in terms of the economy, in terms of social cohesion and social peace. But I do know that one ironic blessing that can come out of this is if we have a circumstance where those who are held in allegiance to the current system of things through mercenary motivations are freed from that allegiance by virtue of the fact that the government's simply not going to be able to pay them. What those people will do, I don't know. I mean, some of them are likely to become very troublesome. But if we have a situation where people are attracted into the service of our country and our republic and our constitution, in whatever way that might be, out of high principle and genuine ideals, I believe that we could do something about reconstructing our republic, rebuilding it on the foundation that still exists, although we've ignored it for very, very long, and now we're starting to reap the consequences of ignoring it. So I'm not, as I said, overwhelmed with optimism, but I do think that one advantage that can come out of a financial collapse of this sort is that it would delegitimize the system that created it. And my hope is that instead of going to the left, as it were, and embracing totalitarianism, that this country will have a renaissance of small r Republican principles. And that's what I'm working for. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I do know I'm going to do everything I can within my limited means to bring it about.
Well, if we don't try, why, of course, we will certainly fail. And only God knows what the ultimate outcome is going to be. But you're doing the best you can. I'm doing the best that I can. And I know there's similar people out all across America who still treasure freedom. Good night, William. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just saying that we're heading towards a total collapse of the system. It can go one of two ways. It can go into a tyrannical dictatorship, which is what the establishment wants, or it can return to a concept of individual freedom under God, the Republican concept, the small r, having nothing to do with the Republican Party, because both political parties are controlled by the same people today. But that idea of a Christian republic with limited government and individual freedom under God, which was the very essence of America, that is what we should be working for, and that's what we can strive for, because we're moving into a crisis situation. It may give us the only opportunity to regain our freedom. So if you need to have more information on what's going on, let me suggest we have two inexpensive pamphlets. One is called The Financial Meltdown. The second is called The History of Money. They're compilations of our newsletters, and you can get them on the internet, or certainly you get the pamphlets which we make up. They're convenient to have just to read and reread. We have now back in print, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. I think this last weekend we got a supply of 20 of them went out simply all over the world through our Amazon website. And then, of course, we also have the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, written by Professor Sutton before he passed away. And then we carry several of his books, Gold for Investment and Gold for Security, as I remember anyway, the two books on gold by Professor Sutton. And then that wonderful little book that goes into the history of what happened in France in 1789 when they did exactly what we're doing today. It's called Fiat Money Inflation in France, because that's what we have today, fiat money inflation. And then, of course, to understand, there is a spiritual force behind everything going on today. And if you doubt that, why, we'd be glad to send you, without charge, a little pamphlet we carry called The Spiritual Hierarchy. Now, of course, it's put out by the Luciferians, by the Lucis Trust. They distribute it, but they tell you that they have their agents in finance and in positions of power all throughout the world today. The Spiritual Hierarchy, if you'd like to get the pamphlet. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope that you'll get my seriously consider getting the book Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, or the talk on the Forbidden Secret. That's the Forbidden Secret. It's actually the DVD. It's got a syllabus with it. If you'd like to know more about any of the items we've mentioned or the suggested gift to obtain them, you can always call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. To understand the true essence of what we're up against, let me suggest Pastor Joe Schimmel's wonderful DVDs, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour versions of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Why is that important? Why, because, of course, there are many people in the music industry who made a pact with the devil, and they will openly admit it. And, of course, they get great wealth and great power and great influence in this life. But, of course, where will they spend eternity? We want you to understand that they're truly the Brotherhood of Darkness, or what's our CD, which, incidentally, we just got 1,000 copies of that in, and they are available through Radio Liberty. We hope, of course, you'll want to get the 4-tape or 4-CD set on the supernatural and the book that goes with that called The Beautiful Side of Evil, written by Johanna Michelson, who was a medium. And she possessed those supernatural gifts, which are given to those that, of course, have gone to the dark side. Now, Johanna will be a speaker at our special conference here on the 26th of October this year. We hope that you'll plan on coming. Dr. Russell Blaylock will be here with us. We're going to have a great program. That's the 26th of October. Give our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.